Well, howdy, y'all. You doing all right? Marty Goetz said, you know, that's how they greet people in his part of the country. They understand that there is you and then there's y'all. And so, howdy. Let me introduce, I told Marty I'm going to slander the arts to start off. So let me just do this and get it over with, and it will set the theme for what I want to do. Tradition. I want to talk about a tradition. I want to talk about a tradition in the Christian church. I want to talk about a tradition in the Christian church that I want to challenge. I want to talk about something going on in some circles of New Testament study, because New Testament study, there are many people who study the New Testament who argue that Israel has become the church. In her rejection of Jesus, the argument goes, Israel has lost her place as the people of God, and the church is the new Israel. A good example of this perspective is Gary Burge's book, Jesus and the Land, the New Testament Challenge to New Testament Theology, to Holy Land Theology. In working through the New Testament, Burge, who I happen to do doctoral studies with in Aberdeen and is a good friend, argues for a landless and nationless theology in which the equality of Jew and Gentile in Christ is the key and only ecclesiological reality. In this view, Jesus as temple, or as forming a new universal temple community, becomes the locus for holy space. So Israel is absorbed into the church, and hope in the land is spiritualized to refer to restored earth. Now, there is some truth in this, even a lot of truth. But to get there, Burge ignores many texts and misses completely the role of Israel in that story. And by making this move, the faithfulness of God is undercut, and an important aspect of God's grace goes missing as God's persistence in the midst of our unfaithfulness is lost. That, in short form, is my thesis. My assignment is to redress that balance, to deal with the tradition. When I speak of Israel, I'm speaking about the Jewish people. That's who I have in mind. I am not speaking about a new Israel. And since most of the texts not treated by Gary Burge in his book appear in Luke Acts, we will survey these two volumes for Israel's continuing story. Apparently, when we do the canon at these conferences, there's Matthew and Luke, and I don't know what happened to Mark, but we'll worry about that later. Burge is not alone. The comprehensive work on Kingdom and Covenant by Peter Gentry and Steve Wellum makes the same omission of material from Luke Acts. Luke Acts is the great secret. Such an omission is significant, since Luke writes more of the New Testament than any other single writer. That includes Paul. These two biblical books comprise almost a third of the New Testament. Sorry, Matthew. Is there hope for God's restoration of original Israel in these texts? And what do these books add to the fulfillment of the Messiah of Israel and what he brings to the world? Well, let's start off by putting Luke Acts in its context. Luke Acts was written somewhere between A.D. 60 and A.D. 80. I tend to prefer the front end of that period. Somewhere in the 60s makes sense, as far as I'm concerned, for where Luke Acts is written. And it was written in order to legitimate the inclusion of Gentiles in an originally Jewish movement as part of God's plan. If you ask, why is Luke written? Why did Luke write Luke and Acts? The answer is he's writing probably to a Gentile, Theophilus, In fact, I'm deeply suspicious Theophilus was a God-fearer. I'm deeply suspicious that Theophilus was a God-fearer who became a Christian having come to Christianity through Judaism and having come to Christ out of the synagogues, because he knows an awful lot of the Old Testament and about the Old Testament that Luke doesn't have to explain if you read Luke and Acts. And his problem is this: what am I as a Gentile doing in what was originally a Jewish movement in which the Jewish people have not been so responsive and which is under terrific pressure? Have they done something they should not have done? And Luke reassures Theophilus that he is right where he ought to be, because it was part of God's plan all along to have what is happening happen. In fact, in the ancient world is not like the modern world. The ancient world is a world in which it's not what's new that's really cool. In the ancient world, it's what's really old that's really cool. And Christianity is the new boy on the block. And so how are you going to defend that Christianity is from God when it's the new boy on the block? Well, the way Luke does it is to say that its roots go back, in the words of that great theologian Chris Berman, back, all the way to the promise of Abraham and to the Abrahamic covenant. And it really is old, but it's a new form and a new era that's part of an old promise. That's the burden of Luke Acts. And in talking about how Gentiles are included, we also have to discuss what that means for Israel, for whom this promise seems so intended, and yet these people have not responded seemingly in mass to what is going on. So Theophilus is a Jesus-believing Gentile who needs assurance. And Luke Acts presents Jesus as God's exalted and vindicated bearer of kingdom promise. He's also the bearer of forgiveness. He's also the bearer of life for all who believe, Jew and Gentile. God's promise does reside now in this community through Jesus Christ. To that extent, Gary Burge has things right. The bestowal of God's Spirit marks the new era's arrival. If you want to know how we're going to know that the new era has come, it is the one who brings the indwelling Spirit to God's people who shows that the new era has come. That message didn't just come from Jesus. That message came from John the Baptist. When the crowd was wrestling with whether John might be the Christ in Luke 3:15-17, in an introduction that is unique to Luke, Luke says the crowd was considering whether John might be the Christ. He answered and said, I am not the Christ by answering this way. He said, I baptize with water, but the one coming after me, I'm not worthy to untie the thong of his sandal. He's going to baptize with the Spirit and fire. The indication of the new era will be, ding, 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 the one who brings the indwelling Spirit of God to God's people. And so this is part of a program that goes back a long way. The message completes promises made to Abraham and Israel, promises made centuries ago. Luke argues that the church roots its message in old promises, a story in continuity with Israel's promised hope found in God's covenantal promises to the nation. The entire saga involves Israel's ultimate restoration, now delayed by her rejection of Messiah, but still to come. For all the Gentile inclusion and equality in the new community brings, we never lose sight of the fact in Luke Acts that this is Israel's story and Israel's hope that brings blessing to the world, just as the Bible tells me so. Just as Genesis 12:3 promised. God keeps his promises to Israel, the seed with as many grains as the sand on the sea and as many people as the stars in the sky. So I want to take our look at Luke Acts, and I want to look at this issue of whether or not Christ in the church serves as the new temple, so there's no future for Israel, and what is at stake. And what is at stake are simply three key ideas. God's faithfulness is at stake because of who he made promises to. God's grace is at stake because the suggestion is that God's response depends on us. And God's promise is at stake because if God can make commitments to Israel and not keep them, what does that mean for God's commitments to us? So, Luke 1 and 2, and the infancy material as a whole. Luke's infancy material tells Israel's story. Just look at all the early references associated with the Jewish nation. I'm just going to run through these. I didn't make a slide for each one of them as Mike Wilkins did. And if I did, the list wouldn't quite be as long as his list of slides, but it's close. Here we go. This is just in the infancy material. John the Baptist is sent to the sons of Israel, Luke 1:16. The child born to Mary is given the throne of David and will rule over the house of Jacob forever, Luke 1:31 and 32. God has helped his servant Israel realize promises spoken to Abraham and to his posterity forever, Luke 1:54 and 55. Remember, this is Luke writing to the church. This is Luke writing somewhere in 60 to 80. He's not revising anything as he presents what the promise is about. Zechariah blesses the God of Israel who has raised up a Davidic horn of salvation as the prophets foretold, Luke 1:68 to 70. Jesus is born in David's city because Joseph is a descendant of David, Luke 2:4. The angels hail Jesus' birth in the city of David, Luke 2:11. Simeon looks for the consolation of Israel. In Luke 2:25, Jesus is a light of revelation for the Gentiles and a glory for his people, Israel, in Luke 2:32. Jesus causes the rise and fall of many in Israel, Luke 2:34. Anna looks for the redemption of Jerusalem, in Luke 2:38. The pious in Israel are looking for the Jewish Messiah. In fact, one of the themes of the infancy material of Luke is that Jesus' birth is surrounded by people who literally radiate piety and faithfulness to God. Whether you're thinking about Zechariah or Elizabeth, you're thinking about Simeon or Anna, or you're thinking about Jesus' own parents. However the Gentiles are impacted by the story of Jesus, and the impact is comprehensive, we never lose Israel in the fresh mix. The themes introduced in this section point to Israel's story. This is confirmed by a closer look at a few of these texts. In Luke 1:32 and 33, Mary is told that the child she will bear will sit on David's throne and rule over Jacob's house. The Davidic throne reflects the Davidic covenant's promise of a son, a house, and an everlasting rule from 2 Samuel 7, especially verses 13 and 16. It is reaffirmed with Solomon's accession in 1 Kings 1:48 and 2:24. The ultimate promise to David is found in its initial fulfillment in Solomon. However, the ultimate fulfillment of the everlasting character of this dynasty is realized in Jesus Christ, Luke 1:33. The initial promise to David was reiterated throughout the Old Testament. And all these passages represent developments and expositions of that covenant. I'm just going to give you the list because I want you to see how comprehensive this promise is that relates to Israel. 1 Kings 2:24, where Solomon is seen as fulfilling the promise. Psalm 89:14. Psalm 89:19-29, and also verses 35 to 37. Psalm 132:11-12. Isaiah 9:6-7. Isaiah 11:1-5, verse 10, and Jeremiah 23:5-6, the exam on what those passages were will be coming later. 1 Chronicles 29:23 tells us this throne on which Solomon now sits after his appointment as king by David is also the throne of the Lord. They are one and the same rule. So the announcement in Luke 1:32 and 33 recalls a deeply held Old Testament promise with roots back into the rule of God over Israel. And Luke made much of Davidic descent in his opening chapters. Luke 1:69 and 2:4 and 2:11 and 3:31 all mention connections to David. Jesus' regal Davidic connection is the basic Christological starting point for Luke's Jesus. In fact, Luke's theology is rooted in the Davidic son's kingdom rule. And the kingdom in Luke includes earthly elements that are not transformed or redefined into something else. As his two volumes will show, Luke's story involves divine history for this earth. Nothing in Luke's story points us to deliverance only into a new realm. All the language Luke uses when describing the kingdom of God is about this world and its deliverance. Luke 1, 32 and 33 represents a continuation of Israel's story. Jesus not only has a regal position, but an everlasting reign. To speak of reigning over a people, which is what these verses do, is another way to refer to the nation of Israel. Some see an allusion here to Jesus gathering a new Israel. There is, however, nothing in the context to suggest this. In fact, Mary's hymn expresses purely national sentiments in Luke 1, 46 to 55, as do Simeon's remarks. Jesus, as God's Messiah, is King of the Jews, whether they recognize him as such or not. The Davidic king comes to his own as well as to the world, and when Gentiles are included, Israel is not excluded. In fact, that if you walk away with one thing from what I'm going to say to you, it's this. Even though we have Gentile inclusion in what Jesus Christ has done, that does not entail Israel's exclusion. Paul always started in the synagogue, as Acts shows, even after Jesus has come. And he has preached the gospel, as he puts it in Romans 1, 16 and 17, and as the title to a well-known book goes, to the Jew first. Jesus rules forever. The idea of an eternal rule in the New Testament emerges from the promise of an eternal line of kings and deliverance figures. These texts portray God's regal rule through the one that he has chosen. Even Second Temple Judaism reflected this idea and this hope. In the Psalms of Solomon 17:4, I'm sure you had your devotions in that work this morning, or 1 Enoch 49:1, or 62:14, or 4Q 174, which is the Florilegium text, which lists all kinds of messianic expectation texts. These texts look forward to a rule on the earth by a king, and Jesus' message taps in to that hope. The phrase, unto the ages, parallels the idea of there shall be no end to this kingdom in Luke 1, 32 and 33, emphasizing the everlasting duration of Jesus' rule. Luke Acts makes clear that neither official Jewish rejection nor crucifixion will stop God's Davidic king. Israel's story will move on, but it will never end. These core infancy accounts and verses show how Luke roots Jesus' story in Israel's hope. There is little Christianized language in these hymns. Even the Greek style of the chapters echoes the Septuagint, or the Greek translation of the Old Testament, to evoke the nation's history. The hope operates in continuity with God's promises. Luke 1, 68 and 69, yet another passage, is another text that's important in thinking about this theme. Zechariah declares that the God of Israel has raised up a Davidic horn for his people. Zechariah's praise focuses on God's visitation in messianic redemption, Luke 1, 68. The opening call to praise points to a praise psalm, and the language is that of Israel's national salvation as the God of Israel is blessed in terms common in the Old Testament and in Second Temple Judaism. These nationalistic features in Luke 1, 68 and 69 argue against reading these verses as holding only transferred Christian significance for Luke. Israel is in view here, as Luke 1, 71 to 73 confirms by its appeal to the covenants. The basis of praise is God's visitation, Luke 1, 68b, specifically God's redeeming, or litrosen, setting free his people. The New Testament scholar Ravens notes that on the four occasions when Luke uses these words for redemption, that is the idea of redeeming, they always refer to Israel and never to Christians or to Gentiles. That's in Luke 1, 68, Luke 2, 38, Luke 24, 21, and Acts 7, 35. As the entire hymn shows, God's visitation comes through Messiah's visitation. Though Zechariah speaks in the past tense in part because Messiah is already conceived, his focus is on what is yet to happen through the Messiah that is certain because God has ordained it. For Luke, God's visitation means God's coming salvation in the Messiah, Jesus. What Messiah's visitation means for God's people is redemption, a deliverance from enemies, so that God's people are free to serve their God in righteousness and holiness all the days of their lives. Luke 1:71 and 1:74-75 suggest a political connotation, especially since the God of Israel is addressed in terms parallel to the Psalms. This is restoration language, but is a political deliverance really in view? Hendrickson argues that the context refers to spiritual salvation or spiritual restoration only, citing Luke 2:38 in support. However, Luke 2 refers to Israel's consolation, 2:25, and to Jesus as a light to the Gentiles and glory for his people Israel in Luke 2:32, and to Jerusalem's redemption in Luke 2:38. The latter phrase goes beyond spiritual restoration as Luke 21:24 and 24:21, Acts 1:6 and 3:19-26 suggest we're going to take closer looks at those passages in a minute. These Lucan texts show that Jerusalem's redemption includes the Son of Man's rule and judgment on earth. The political connotation is not absent. Rather, political redemption is delayed because of the nation's failure to respond. Luke 13:31-35 and 19:44. Again, even though Gentiles are included in the blessing noted here, there is no indication their presence negates Israel's role in blessing. It is a complete non sequitur to argue that Gentile inclusion means Israeli exclusion. Thus, redemption involves both political and spiritual elements, nationalistic themes, and the offer of forgiveness. Zechariah praises God for the expectation of a total deliverance. Such a linkage between spiritual and political blessing is not surprising, since it parallels the blessing and curse sections of Deuteronomy. What is new is the division into two distinct phases tied to Jesus' two comings. Of course, Zechariah had no such twofold conception here. He simply presents the total package. Subsequent events explain the division and present a hope split into two parts due to the vindication of Israel's rejected Messiah. Luke 2:25-34, briefly. Simeon, an old pious man, is awaiting Israel's consolation. Such consolation is a key theme in many strands of the Old Testament and in Second Temple Jewish eschatology that refers to Israel's deliverance. And the texts include Isaiah 40, verse 1, Isaiah 49, 13, Isaiah 51, 3, Isaiah 57, 18, Isaiah 61, 2, and 2 Baruch 44, 7. I threw that last one in there just to see if you were awake. Echoing Isaiah 42:6, Simeon refers to Jesus as light, a revelation for the nations, and glory for your people, Israel. In Luke, we do not choose between Israel and the nations. Rather, the story, Israel's story, is for the nations as well. Again, Gentile inclusion does not mean Israeli exclusion. The appearance of Jew and Gentile alongside each other is a theme of the infancy material. It is a theme one should never lose sight of in thinking about eschatology. The inclusion of the Gentiles does not mean the exclusion of Israel. Luke 3:24. In Luke 4:16-30, we see Jesus at the synagogue declaring himself as Spirit-anointed. Continuing to unfold Israel's story as described in Isaiah 61, he is the servant that Isaiah has predicted has come. Today, this scripture is fulfilled in your hearing. Pointing to the time of Elijah and Elisha and the healing of the widow of Zarephath, a Gentile, and Naaman the Syrian, a Gentile, Jesus notes how in times past, blessing bypassed Israel and went to the Gentiles. The warning to the nation is that if she rejects God's message, then the blessing may not come to her, but may go to Gentiles. Israel's story has an obstacle, her own rejecting heart. The question is whether that obstacle is permanent or not. Some may claim it is permanent. Israel has lost her place because she has turned her back on God and the promise of Messiah. Later texts in Luke answer this question, so the result should not be assumed. And so we turn to the text that suggests that Israel does have a future. Luke 13, 34, and 35. It's the first key text of several I'm going to discuss. When substantial rejection comes out of Israel, Jesus warns the nation about the risk. In Luke 13, 6 to 9, Jesus says, "The vine that does not produce fruit will be cut down." Again, the question surfaces, is this a permanent judgment against Israel? This leads us into Luke 13, 34, and 35. This is a crucial text. Luke 13 details the nature of the penalty Israel faces for missing the time for visitation, as Luke 19, 41 to 44 puts it later. In Luke 13, 34, Jesus speaks as a prophet of the Lord's repeated longing to gather the nation as a hen gathers her brood under her wing. The image of God as a bird is common in the Old Testament and in Second Temple Jewish texts. And the God of Israel's desire is to intimately care for, nurture, and seek to protect his people. The reference to repeated attempts to gather the nation might allude to the many prophets he sent throughout Israel's history. Only one thing stopped God from exercising his parental care. The people did not wish him to do so. As a result, the gathering and its protection could not take place. The same risk now applies to Jesus' offer. In Luke 13, 35, Jesus underscores the situation. Israel is in peril. The language of the empty, desolate house recalls Jeremiah 12, 7 and 22, 5. The parallel in Matthew 23, 39 mentions that the house is desolate, but Luke lacks this particular term. The Old Testament declared the possibility of exile for a nation if it did not respond to God's call about exercising justice, Jeremiah 22, 5 and 6. As such, Jesus' use of the term oikos does not allude to the temple. Jesus is more emphatic than Jeremiah's statement of the nation's potential rejection. A time of abandoning exile has come. Your house is abandoned. Rather than being gathered under God's wings, their house is empty and exposed. But for how long? It is important to recall that the exile was not permanent. And it's important to recall now that this exile also will not be permanent. There is the hope of return and restoration, even in the midst of temporary judgment and isolation. Jesus adds a note about the judgment's duration. Israel will not see God's messenger until they recognize the one who comes in the name of the Lord. This is the first of three key until texts in Luke Acts. Luke has already made clear that the key term, the one who comes, means Messiah, Luke 3, 15 and 16 and Luke 7, 19. Israel to accept Jesus as sent from God. Until the nation accepts him, it stands alone, exposed to the world's dangers. It is a house that has not been gathered under the wing of its protecting God. The quotation from Psalm 118 ultimately, however, is positive. It's not negative. It suggests that Israel's judgment is only for a time. That's the first passage. The second is Luke 21, 24. This verse pictures a turnaround in Israel's fate. Near the end of the eschatological discourse in which Jesus is describing both the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70 and how that is a picture and a pattern and a mirror for the chaos of what the end is going to be like, Jesus describes, and Luke describes, Jerusalem being trodden down for a time and refers to this period as, quote, the times of the Gentiles, close quote. What does this verse mean? It refers to a period of Gentile domination, while alluding, I think implying, a subsequent hope for Israel. There are three reasons for maintaining this reading. First, the city's fall is described as being of limited duration. Why else mention a time limit? Okay, Jerusalem is trampled over until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. This means that Israel sees a future for ethnic Israel, however he conceives of the new movement's relationship to the Jewish nation. Second, there is a period in God's plan when Gentiles dominate, which implies that the subsequent period will be characterized by Israel's role, because consistently in the scripture where you get Gentiles contrasted with someone, they are consistently contrasted with Israel. Jesus' initial coming and his future eschatological return represent turning points in God's plan. Third, this view of Israel's judgment, now but vindication later, suggests what Paul also contends for in Romans 11, 25 and 26. Israel has a future grafted back in when the fullness of Gentiles leads her to respond. See also Romans 11, 11 and 12. 11:15 and 11:30-32. These chapters certainly have ethnic Israel in view. That is Romans 9-11. Paul begins it by saying, I'm talking about the Israel that I weep over. I'm talking about the Israel that I wish I was accursed so that they could be saved. This is not about a new Israel. This is about the old and the Israel that for the most part has not responded to the Messiah. So we're looking at ethnic Israel and not a concept of spiritual Israel. Romans 9 to 11 develops the temporary period of judgment noted in Luke 13, 34 and 35. It is crucial to understand that Romans 9 to 11, and I'm stepping over into someone else's territory here, but I've got to unite the New Testament or else I don't feel good about what I'm doing. It is crucial to understand that Romans 9 to 11 is about Israel and not a spiritualized Israel. These are the people Paul weeps for, as I just mentioned in Romans 9, 1-5, wishing he were cursed so that they might be saved. They're the same people he hopes for in all Israel in Romans 11. Nothing Paul says changes that audience, for this hope in that section is the topic throughout the entirety of that section. In fact, the contrast in Romans 11 with Gentiles that leads into the claim that Israel will one day be redeemed is made clear by the picture of if Gentiles can be grafted in and you can be cut off, then how much easier is it for God to graft Israel back in again? It's very, very clear who we're talking about. So Romans 11 matches the hope of Luke Acts. This means that the two most prolific authors of the New Testament declare a future hope for Israel. Between those two writers, you're covering two-thirds of the New Testament. We've talked about two passages. Let me add one more. Luke 24, 21, the last passage in Luke I will discuss. These passages in Luke 13, 34, and 35, and 21, 24 describe the hope that seemed to have been blocked by Jewish rejection of Jesus as Messiah. Jesus' death revised this hope as a result of resurrection. But immediately after the resurrection, this was not yet clear. Luke 24, 21 has one of the disciples still sorting out what's going on because he's just heard about the empty tomb. He says they had hoped Jesus would redeem Israel. Interesting. This is the only time that Luke uses the verb latruo, to redeem, in his gospel. If this hope is the same as what Zechariah expressed in Luke 1, 68-79, that it included the connotation of a political release for the people. That's part of what they were hoping for. Dylan's comment that Israel means broadly the people of God and not strictly the Jewish nation fails on four counts. First, it fails to note the disappointment expressed here. Second, it fails to take seriously the infancy narrative background that we've already traced. Third, it fails to recall that part of the disappointment was that our chief priests and rulers handed Jesus over. And four, it fails to account for the Jewish perspective that pervades the entire account. The Jewish disciples in Luke 24, 21 still think of Israel as a socio-political unit. They had hoped for her deliverance. Jesus' death had seemingly put an end to that hope, and the prospect of the empty tomb was leaving the door open for that hope. But those speaking with Jesus on the Emmaus Road had not put the puzzle together yet. And this uncertainty fits the time period of the remarks before the church operated as an autonomous unit. The focus on the nation in the early chapters of Acts adds to the weight of this interpretation. Israel here means Israel. They were hoping for the nation's future. So when we come to the end of Luke's gospel, where do we stand? Israel's story remains and develops. None of the above Lucan texts we have focused on appear in Burgess' Jesus and the Land. They represent a significant omission. To include Gentiles does not mean Israel has been excluded. Jesus comes for both groups. Even the judgment on Israel for rejecting her Messiah is like her being in exile, with it very less than clear that the door has been closed on hope for her. Does the book of Acts help to complete the picture? I'm going to try and cover the book of Acts quickly. On a literary level, I'm talking now about Acts 1, 4-7. On a literary level, the remark in Acts 1, 4 and 5 points back to Luke 24, 49. In Luke 24, 49, Jesus told the disciples to wait in Jerusalem until they were clothed with the Spirit, till they were clothed with power and the promise of the Father. Jesus commands the disciples not to depart from Jerusalem, but to begin the mission from there. Waiting for the promise of the Father, the disciples perceive this event as an indication of the end's full arrival, which leads to their question in verse 6 about the restoration of the kingdom to Israel. Many Jewish texts expected that Israel would be restored to a place of great blessing. And I have three lines of a list of texts that I'm going to skip over for the sake of time that come out of the Old Testament and out of Second Temple Judaism about equal from each set of materials. The question is a natural one for Jews. Is this the time you're going to restore the kingdom to Israel? Luke 1 and 2 express the hope vividly. What was debated in Judaism is whether the centrality of Israel would be positive or negative for Gentiles. Would it come with salvation or judgment for the nations? The disciples are not even thinking in mission terms here. Their question reflects a nationalistic concern for vindication, and nothing Jesus did or said in the 40 days he was with them after resurrection dissuaded them from this expectation. I can't tell you how important that is. Jesus spends 40 days with them. They're interacting back and forth. He's sharing Old Testament texts with them. He's taking them through an eschatology 101 class, and he is the professor. And as he does this, when it's all done, the time comes for a final examination. The one question they want to ask the prof is this the time you're going to restore the kingdom to Israel? Now, Jesus doesn't react by pulling out his hair and getting my hairline, okay? What Jesus does is he says, that's the Father's business. He doesn't challenge the premise of the question. He says, in the meantime, you've been given a mission to do, so go do it. He doesn't say, you know, you need to re-enroll in Eschatology 101 and we're going to go over this so we can change the question at the end. Nothing Jesus did or said in the 40 days he was with them after resurrection dissuaded them from this expectation. Neither does Jesus' answer. Nothing in Luke's story should dissuade us from holding on to this hope for Israel. Again, Gentile inclusion does not mean Israeli exclusion. Neither does Jesus' reply in verses 7 and 8 reject the question's restoration premise. The reading following the Luke-Acts storyline stands in contrast to interpretations such as John Stott's, who sees the question as full of errors. In Stott's view, the disciples should not have asked about restoration, since that implied a political kingdom, nor about Israel, since that anticipated a national kingdom, nor about at this time, since that implied the kingdom's immediate establishment. Jesus' reply does not suggest that anything they asked was wrong, except that they are excessively concerned about exactly when this will happen, something that is the Father's business. The major argument Stott makes is that there is no mention of land in the New Testament. However, land is not mentioned since, one, Israel is in its land when all of the New Testament is written. And two, the rule of Jesus is anticipated to extend over the entire earth, so why focus on this particular land? In fact, neither the definition of Israel nor the expectation for Israel changes. Rather, God's eschatological work is now centered in Jesus. Throughout Acts, Jesus is the blessing's mediator. Throughout Acts, Israel's role remains central to the hope of salvation. Including the expectation of national restoration, Acts 10 through 15 works out this story as it extends the taking of the gospel into all the world. Jesus did not answer the question about Israel's restoration and its timing, nor is his response a renunciation of an imminent end. It makes no commitment at all as to when the end comes. These verses show the disciples are still thinking in terms of Israel's story. Nothing Jesus did or said in those key days altered that ultimate hope for the nation. What was changing was the scope of their assignment and concern. They were to take Messiah's message to the entire world. A global perspective was becoming more important as a part of Israel's story because up to this point, Israel had failed to represent God in such a way that God was honored in the world. God would take care of his business and promises to Israel one day. In the meantime, the disciples were and are to take the message of hope to the world. Our last key passage, Acts 3:18-21. Acts 3:18-21. And the theme under this verse is, just read all about it. In this speech, Peter puts everything together and speaks of Jesus' return. The times of refreshing refer to future restoration. The term for refreshing refers to a cooling that is able to relieve trouble or dry out a wound. In the Septuagint, the only use of refreshment is in Exodus 8:11, where it refers to relief from the plague of the frogs, so you get a sense of what its force is. The verb to refresh is used of the Sabbath rest of slaves and animals and the soothing of Saul by David's music. Peter prophesies a messianic refreshment, the definitive age of salvation. The idea has parallels in Second Temple Judaism, and here I am going to read this series of texts. 2 Esdras 7:75, 91, and 95, 11:46, 13:26, and 29, 2 Baruch 73 and 74, 1 Enoch 45:5, and 51:4, and 93:6. Hike. Peter urges them to read what God has already said through the prophets. Texts such as Isaiah 65 and 66 are in view, where Israel is restored to fullness. Nothing in any of this says that the story already revealed has been changed. God is faithful. He keeps his promises to Israel even as he extends himself to include the nations. Gentile inclusion does not preclude Israeli inclusion. The question is not if, but when. In the end, Israel will also be blessed. In our narrative sequence, this is a crucial text. It tells us what is to come was already disclosed. Whatever the expansion of the promise to Gentiles entails, it does not remove or redefine Israel's story. When Peter says that what is to come is revealed in, quote, the mouth of his holy prophets from of old in Acts 3:21, he is saying God has revealed what he will do for Israel one day. You can still read all about it in the Hebrew scripture. Nothing God said there is changed by what Jesus did or does. God can add detail to his program. He can develop it, but that does not take place at the expense of what he has already revealed and committed himself to do for Israel. Sometimes it is suggested that this is a speech early on in Acts, before Peter learned more about Gentile involvement. That point, at one level, is correct. Peter did learn more about how Gentiles were included in God's program and plan as the book of Acts proceeds. But that does not mean that the commitments to Israel changed. We have already shown, and we are continuing to argue, that Gentile inclusion does not mean Israeli exclusion. So as Peter learns more about Gentile blessing, that does not mean the promises and program for Israel has changed. Summary on other key texts, and then I conclude. Acts 10 and 11 and Acts 28:20. Chapters 10 and 11, just summarizing. In the two passages involving Cornelius in Acts 10 and 11, the Spirit's coming shows that Gentiles are equal to Jews in blessing, so that circumcision is not required of Gentiles since they receive the Spirit without having to get circumcised. Just think Jewishly about this for a minute. Put your kippah or yarmulke on the top of your head. See, mine fits very nicely right here. And when you do that, you will understand from a Jewish point of view that you don't get a spirit indwelling a vessel unless it is clean. So when the Spirit comes down into Gentiles in chapter 10 and 11, the Jewish believers present, Peter and the six with him, all go, "Did you see that?" Because they inherently understand that the only way that a spirit could indwell a Gentile is if God has cleansed the Gentiles. He says as much in chapter 15 of Acts. The Spirit's coming shows that Gentiles are equal to Jews in blessing, so that circumcision is not required of the Gentiles. The Spirit occupying uncircumcised Gentiles shows they are already cleansed and sacred, set apart. They're already saints. The new era's sign comes to Gentiles as Gentiles. There is no need for them to become Jews. Israel's story has finally come to touch the world and bless the nations. As Genesis 12, 1-3 had said, God keeps his word to Gentiles as well as to Israel. In Acts 28:20, Paul tells the Jews he is in chains for the hope of Israel. Now we've gotten to the end of Acts. Acts 28, I will remind you, is the last chapter in the book. Paul is on trial for the hope of the 12 tribes. That's Acts 26, 6 and 7. Hope involves declaring light both to the people of Israel and Gentiles with a story from the prophets and Moses, Acts 26, 22, and 23. Paul says that he worships the God of the fathers, believing everything laid down by the law or written in the prophets, having a hope in God which they themselves accept, that there will be a resurrection of both the just and the unjust, Acts 24, 14, and 15. Paul tells Israel's story. Nothing suggests that the story has changed from the one told in the infancy material, in the teaching of John the Baptist, in the teaching of Jesus, or the teaching of Peter. In Luke, Acts, this is one story. Israel has a hope. The Bible tells me so. John the Baptist tells me so. Jesus tells me so. Peter tells me so. And last but not least, Paul tells me so. For Luke, Acts, Israel's story has not changed. It is a story of hope for the world. Gentile inclusion does not mean Israeli or Jewish exclusion. This warns us not to rewrite the story that the Torah and the prophets gave us about original Israel. We can add nations into the promise through Christ, the ultimate seed, but we cannot lose sight of the hope in the promised one that belonged to the original Israel and that still exists for her. I got asked a question yesterday by Michael Brown on the radio, and it was this. If Christ is the ultimate seed of Abraham and everything is fulfilled in him, then why does Israel need to continue to have a hope? It's a good question. And the answer is simple. Because it is Christ's intent in the context of God's program to complete his promises that he made to Israel. This warns us not to rewrite the story of the Old Testament. Some contemporary readings of Paul in the New Testament suggest we should change this story when we read those ancient texts and think of Israel in a different way that excludes or minimizes original Israel. However, for Luke, Acts, Jesus' story is Israel's story, as well as a story that blesses the world. It anticipates a future time when Israel responds to Jesus and God restores the nations as the prophets promised. Israel and the nations one day will respond to God as one and be reconciled to one another. That is a big part of the ultimate story. This is where the hope of the land comes in. For when Jesus returns, it is to rule from Jerusalem. The times of the Gentiles will be over. Jesus, the glory of Israel, will bless the world in his presence. Israel and the world will be at peace because Gentile inclusion completes Israeli inclusion as promise becomes reality for both groups. Reconciliation will be achieved, as will shalom for all. In the meantime, the gospel goes out into the world for both Jew and Gentile to preview what is to come for Israel and the world. Dun, 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 dun 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 dun. I want to change the tradition. And here it is. Gentile inclusion does not mean the loss of Israel. Gentile inclusion does not mean the loss of Israel. Thank you.